Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host Mono here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. We're right in the middle of Obon season in Japan. It's when Japanese people honor the spirits of their ancestors. For me, though, it's all about the festivals, the Bon Odori dancing, and that ice-cold kakigori. I went to the Bon Festival in Nakano and had a great time. And this late summertime is a popular one for game releases. I'm joined by JRPG streamers Becca and Swice-senpai to chat about two big new games on the Nintendo Switch, Live Alive and Xenoblade Chronicles 3. We dig deep into what's great about the newest additions to the Switch's growing RPG catalog. Also, I recently beat Triangle Strategy, so I'll share my final thoughts. This episode's feature is about the newly opened Bandai Namco Cross Store in Yokohama, featuring a Pac-Man shop. Also, a capybara might appear. You'll have to listen to find out. And in the news, I'll break down the details from the new Pokemon and Splatoon presentations. Let's jump right into the games to chat Live Alive and Xenoblade Chronicles 3 with Becca and Swice-senpai. It's been JRPG season for Nintendo Switch fans, with both Live Alive and Xenoblade Chronicles 3 launching on the hardware just a week apart from each other. Joining me are two JRPG superfans to tell us all about these intriguing titles. So guests, please introduce yourselves.
Hey, how's it going, guys? My name is Swice, and I'm very passionate for JRPGs in general, more so the combat systems. And I've been playing through a lot of new ones, and I can't wait to give my thoughts on them.
Hey, it's Becca, also go by Bex. I am really excited to be here. I have loved JRPGs since I can remember, so it'll be really fun to talk about them.
Thank you so much for joining me today. A general question, how did both of you get into JRPGs?
So for me, I can't exactly remember when. I just know that ever since I was like 3 or 4, I've had a controller in my hands, and I started with the NES and Super NES. We mostly had JRPGs in my house. It was, my dad was a Zelda fan, so I either played that, and then he would find anything that looked similar, so anything with like an anime style. So I also played a lot of Secret of Mana, Illusion of Gaia. Anything that I would see the cover and I was like, ooh, this one looks cool. And it all just so happened to be JRPGs, and I've been in love with them since.
So yeah, and then for me, when I was younger, I played Kingdom Hearts. That was actually my first game I've ever played. I used to play at my cousin's with no memory card. So we would just replay the intro over and over, and it seriously mesmerized me as a kid. I thought it was so cool, creepy. The music put me in like a trance. I was like, this is crazy. And then I actually didn't play any JRPGs up until I was out of high school. And I was still playing through the Kingdom Hearts series. And then I would play like shooters on the side, like Call of Duty and stuff like that. And I was like, is there more games like this? Like, I was a total noob. I was like, I want to play more games with these types of crazy stories, this beautiful music. And I actually came across this game called Shining Resonance Refrain. And compared to other JRPGs, it's not the most bombastic series. It's a really fun game, and I would totally recommend it. But I played it, and I was like in love instantly. And I was like, okay, there's a genre that is like for me. So since then, I've just tried to find as many JRPGs as I can. And I really haven't played anything else since. And I just really found the passion for them. And I was like, this is what I loved so much about Kingdom Hearts, was just what JRPGs do in general with their stories, gameplay, and music.
Wow. And now both of you are JRPG streamers. I've always wanted to know, do you think streaming JRPGs in general is difficult since there's a lot of reading and menu management?
Yes.
Yeah. So for me, most of the games that I've streamed so far have been early. Like the newest one that I've played was from 2007, if we're not including the Live Alive remaster. So most of the games I had to read dialogue, and three of the games I played were Trails games. And if you know Trails at all, you know that those games have so much dialogue. So there's a lot of me reading, but it's not so bad, especially since like I would take breaks and talk to my chat and they were very interactive and they were very involved in the story and very interested. So I did think it was going to be really difficult. I thought I would just be sitting there talking to myself, but it's really not as intimidating as it seems. I have a lot of fun in my streams. It's really a great community that comes around with JRPGs. So there's always lots to talk about. So if you do get tired of reading or there's a lot of dialogue, you kind of do get to take a break and talk to chat, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then for me, because I play a lot of newer JRPGs, she's actually been getting me into older ones, which have been a lot of fun. But streaming them is a whole different story because, like she said, she has to read the whole time. For me, it's more reacting to cutscenes. Like, I'm really there just watching what's going on through the story. And for me specifically, a lot of people like to watch me do challenge mode stuff or hard mode stuff. So it's a lot of fun, especially when everyone's rooting me on and we get some challenges done and it's super rewarding. But it can totally get stressful at times when I'm going through a first playthrough. I've never played the game before and I'm playing it on a hard mode, you know, and sometimes the chat will want to give me all their tips, but, you know, I still want to play it through the first time on my own. And sometimes you just get beat by a boss 20 times in a row and you're on stream and you're like, holy, this is pretty tough, but it's a lot of fun. And I couldn't see myself streaming anything else. Like, I have way too much fun going through a JRPG story, getting blown away either by a boss fight or story beats. So it's a lot of fun. But then there's also some issues when, like, you're trying to read chat and there's a big cutscene going on. I've been trying to learn that recently because I'm still semi-new to streaming. So I actually missed a, like, big part of this cutscene in Xenoblade 3. For, like, 1 second, I turned the chat and I missed it. And it was, yeah, it's like you got to learn when to do stuff. You know, chat's not going to be mad if you're watching an important cutscene. And so it's a bit different than just streaming like a shooter where you're just focused on, you know, your multiplayer match for the 30 minutes you're doing it.
Awesome. And we've got two really unique games to look at today. Let's start with Live Alive since it came out first. It's an HD 2D remake of the original 1994 game only released in Japan. It's perhaps most notable for being Takashi Tokita's directorial debut. Becca, what was your reaction to the announcement for this remake?
Live Alive is one of those games that I learned about years ago. It's probably been about 10 years now. I remember reading about games that never got released to the West. And it was one that really intrigued me because I liked how unique the story sounded. And everybody that I knew that played it really enjoyed it. And so whenever I actually decided to record my reaction to the Nintendo Direct because I was like, it probably won't have anything that I'm interested in, but just in case it does. And I was so excited. I don't remember the last time I was ever so excited for an announcement because this is one that I had been hoping for so long. So to finally be able to play it, it was one of the happiest announcements I've ever seen.
Perhaps the most interesting element of the game is the structure, where you have chapters focusing on different protagonists in different time periods. What did you think about this approach to the RPG?
I actually really loved it. I don't know if I would like it in every game, but I feel like the way that they did it was really well done. I felt like I was playing a different game with each chapter, and they were all pretty short. It was like maybe they could be anywhere between an hour to 5 hours long. So if you didn't have a lot of time, you could sit there and do one person's chapter. And then the next day you could go and do another person's. And it was a lot of fun because depending on my mood, I would decide who I wanted to be because there's a wrestler, another one, you're in the Wild West, and you're a gunslinger, and another one, you're a robot. So it felt like it gave me a different game to play every day, which was very refreshing. And each one of them was a lot of fun. They were all unique. and I had a blast with every single one of them.
Did you have a favorite chapter that stood out?
To me, so I really liked the Shinobi chapter. That one was a lot of fun because you used a lot of stealth in it. But the one that was surprising to me was the robot chapter. I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm really gonna want to run around like as a robot, because I usually pick like the anime boys because those are my favorites. But the robot chapter, it had me hooked from beginning to end. And when I was streaming it, my whole chat was going crazy during certain parts of it. It was just like one of the most fun times I've had on stream. And I think they did a really good job with it. So that one is really special to me for that reason.
Without getting too heavy into spoilers, were you satisfied with how the stories tied together? One criticism with Octopath Traveler is that the characters really didn't interact much with each other.
So I never played Octopath, but I feel like Live Alive did such a good job with it. I was very happy. I think they did a lot better than I was even expecting to, because when I was getting close to the ending, I was like, okay, how are they going to tie it together? I really don't see what they're going to do at all. And when they did, I was blown away by it. I thought it was really well done. And I was planning on doing the finale stream. I was like, oh, it'll probably only be like 3 hours. And I ended up doing almost a 10-hour stream because I was just trying to do like so much stuff in it. There's like so much stuff you don't have to do, but you can do. I just thought it was really well put together. One of the best endings I've ever played in a game. It really blew me away.
Are you a big HD 2D fan, or would you like to see a different style for these types of remakes?
I really do like the HD 2D. I actually wasn't really much of a fan at first because I felt like the outer side of the view was so blurry. And I was like, I don't really like that. But after playing Live Alive, I have a new appreciation for it. And maybe if they did something else, I really liked the Game Boy Advanced SP style graphics. Honestly, the sprites, I felt like they were very colorful, very vibrant. So maybe if they did something like that, but like a little more high def, maybe like bigger and grander in scheme. But yeah, other than that, I feel like if they do stick with the 2D HD, it'll be really good and I'll enjoy them.
What did you think of the soundtrack? It was actually Yoko Shimomura's first title she worked on while at Square.
So it's actually one of my favorite video game soundtracks now. There was one song in it. And so they actually have a jukebox in the main menu. And whenever I would be done playing the game, I would just sit there and go through the music and just listen to it after my stream was done. And there was one song that I played constantly. Like if I was cleaning or doing anything else, I would just have my Switch on in the background and I played it. It was so good. I think the soundtrack to that game is amazing.
Last question about Live Alive. If they were going to make a Live Alive 2 with the same structure, what kind of time periods or settings would you like to see?
Ooh, that's a really interesting one. I feel like they did pretty much everything that they could do. Maybe, that's a really interesting question. Maybe if they did like a modern day, because they had a modern day one, but it was like the wrestler and the way you did it, you didn't really go out and you didn't visit town so much. So maybe if they incorporated more of like a present day theme, like, I don't know, they could do something like Persona and have like a school theme. That would be kind of cool. Or I don't know. I think they did really good. I'm not sure what else I would put, to be honest.
Let's jump to Xenoblade Chronicles 3. So I Senpai, what's your history with the franchise?
So Xenoblade, aside from Kingdom Hearts, which basically just stole my heart as a kid, Xenoblade would have been my favorite franchise because I just think it's incredible in almost every area. It's almost crazy how big the games are and they're on the Switch. Mm. So I actually started with Xenoblade 2 a little bit after it released, and I saw a bunch of memes on it on Twitter. Like, everyone was honestly making fun of Rex and these cutscenes. I'm like, what is this game? I have to try it. So I tried it, and within probably an hour, I was just hooked. I thought it was incredible, the intro. And I like had an incredible experience through this game. It almost brought back a love for playing video games because I haven't played a game like this in so long. So when I finished it, it became just one of my all-time favorite games. I would actually say it's my second favorite game of all time would be Xenoblade 2. And during my playthrough of that, I just went out and bought a physical for Xenoblade 1 Definitive Edition because I was like, I'm obviously going to want to play this after. So right after it, I went straight into Xenoblade 1, and it was another masterpiece. I didn't enjoy it as much as 2, but it was pretty close and still up there with like some of the best games I've personally ever played. It's pretty deep in my heart for video games.
I think the thing that struck me the most about Xenoblade 3 is the party size. You can control 7 different characters in battle. How does this huge party size change the battle dynamic compared to past games?
So it actually changes up combat a lot, and in the best way. So I was initially worried the Switch hardware would not be able to handle 7 party members there at once. I was also worried, how would the player be able to manage the party members like this? The AI is going to need to be tuned. It needs to be better than Xenoblade 1 and 2. And to my surprise, it was done almost perfectly. Being able to swap through party members now, and 7 of them, is very useful, because if you are playing an attacker role, for example, and your medic is just not doing it, you could swap right over to your healing class yourself and do it. So it makes combat a lot more fast-paced and just more variety. You could play as whoever you want now, and they could have whatever class they want. So it is more to manage. Your brain is going to be a little bit more twisted seeing 7 party members running around and trying to manage it all. But being able to focus on like 1 or 2 people and then letting the AI do the rest with the teams that you built is really fun. The AI has been tuned up really well. The medics do their jobs, the tanks do their jobs. So I think the party system of having 7 people at once is a total upgrade and definitely welcomed.
One big new battle mechanic is the interlink, where you combine 2 characters to fight in like a big robot. Is this more like a super attack, or is there more depth to it?
So there's definitely more depth to it. It's actually, I wouldn't compare it to a super move. I would actually, there's stuff called talent arts, which I would actually refer to more as a super move, because that's like, you do your role good enough, you get this kind of little tiny little cutscene move that does an extra damage. The interlink is kind of more to save your butt in combat. Like, I'm about to die, let me interlink. And it basically gives you, I want to say, 15 seconds of powerful moves, but they don't do much unless you spend time through a battle and upgrade it to level 3, because as you're doing the battle, it'll go from 1, 2, 3, and then that's really when stuff heats up and you want to go into interlink, and it lets you do a whole bunch of stuff. You could start combos out, you could hear your whole team. So in the beginning, it's kind of just for, okay, I'm about to die, let me just go into this real quick and then pop out of it. So it's a really interesting mechanic. It could have so much depth to it if you want to set it up to be like that. Or you could just keep it there in the back pocket in case you're about to die, you know, and you go into it. Because some of your party members, when they interlink, they could heal your whole party and stuff like that. So you keep that in the back of your mind. You know, if you have no healing arts ready and you need a heal, you go into your interlink real quick and then pop out of it.
The series is also famed for its open world featuring a lot of creatures, including many that are way too tough to defeat when you first encounter them. How would you say the overworld has evolved with this title?
So they definitely have nailed it with this entry. It was great in Xenoblade 1 and 2, but with 3, they did a fantastic job of making you not do the main story, because there's so much fun stuff that catches your eye around every corner. And a lot of those is the monsters as well. Now, I definitely had the Xenoblade moment where I was level 5 and a big giant monkey that's level 88 stepped on me in the first 5 minutes. And I always love that for Xenoblade games. But this one is even more spectacular. I mean, you could jump in the water and there will be like sea monsters, dragon monsters swimming around. The scenery is just really, really cool. They seem to have combined the worlds of 1 and 2 and kind of just put them in a blender. And then that's what you're left with. And it makes for some really cool scenery. And then for exploring, they basically took the best mechanics from 1 and 2, in my opinion, and then put them in 3. So the questing and exploring is really, really good. So you never get bored really running around.
Yeah, that monkey is really popular. Everyone seems to love him.
Yeah, he's like a staple to every Xenoblade game. I would have been sad if I didn't see him in 3.
I'm also hearing a lot of positive things about these side quests. Were there any that stuck with you?
Pretty much all of them. I made a tweet a while back. I think this has set a bar in at least some way, shape, or form for JRPG side quests. I have not played a game because I hear a lot of praise for the Trail series for side quests. I have not personally played those, so I can't comment on those. But the way Xenoblade 3 did their side quests, where they connect them to the main story very heavily, more so than I've ever seen a game do, mix that with they kept their cutscene production as high as it is for the main story. You will have these crazy choreographed fight scenes and deep story moments in your side quests. So that is really spectacular to me, and I have not seen that done before. And now it's almost like if I go do side quests in another game, I'm extremely bored because I'm not getting this cool stuff. And some of the side quests, because you do them for heroes, you collect heroes through the game, and each of the side quests is usually for a hero. These heroes will end up talking to each other and coming across each other through the game as well. So they just did an insane job at merging side quests with the main story. And then my favorite part is they kept their production value for the side quests. It doesn't feel like side quests sometimes. It just feels like you're still playing the main story.
We really haven't talked about the story yet. It has a pretty interesting premise. How are you liking the story so far?
I love it. It might be a little too depressing for me at times. I like my Xenoblade 2, where they have that contrast of goofy mixed with intense sometimes. This story is written extremely well. Like, I'm pretty surprised at how amazing this story is, but it's a very dark story, but it's insane, I would say. That's the word I would use, is insane. That's why the chapters trend on Twitter and stuff. It's just pretty crazy. Definitely the writing has improved over 1 and 2, I would say. My specialty is more in combat, not so the writing and story stuff. Like, I'm pretty I get entertained very easily with stories. But I could definitely see, like, I was like, oh, this moment is really smart and well done for that twist or stuff like that. So the story, I'm pretty sure anyone who plays this game will enjoy the story. There's a lot of new fans getting into the series just starting with Xenoblade 3 because they hear the hype. And that's all I would say to do with the story. I would definitely say the story is the pinnacle of this game and what most people are going to be playing it for.
Great. And last question, if they add one character from Xenoblade Chronicles 3 into Smash Brothers, who should it be?
I want to say Noah, just because he's the main pro tag, but then also Mio, because she's kind of like another main pro tag. And we have so many, Shulk and Pyra, Mythra, and Smash have giant swords, so Noah would just have a giant sword. At least Mio would have those little, you know, circular ring knives that she uses. So I would love to see any Xenoblade 3 rep. That would be super cool to have Xenoblade 1, 2, and 3 all have Smash reps. So Noah or Mio would be cool with me. Pretty much anybody. But if they were, they would probably choose the main pro tags. So it would be Noah or Mio. They might even have a way you could swap between them in battle. They could even do that because of the interlinking. So that's what I would personally want to see. Put them both in.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad I got to chat about both these amazing titles with all of you. All right, so where can people find you?
For me, I'm most of the time on Twitch streaming at twitch.tv/swicesenpai. I have the same name for all my socials. If not, I'm tweeting a lot on Twitter. People seem to really enjoy my Twitter. And then other than that, I have a YouTube that I don't do as much as Twitch and Twitter because I'm just very busy. I'm trying my hardest to get that going a lot faster, but I definitely still upload quality stuff there from time to time. Like, I just actually posted a Xenoblade 3 beginner guide to learn the combat a bit better. And I think that's a pretty well done video. So I definitely do upload there. But yeah, you could find me at Swice Senpai, any of the socials, Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, even TikTok.
My socials, I have different names for everything. My Twitter, I am mostly active on there. It's Becca.Sizemore. And on my Twitch, it's Bex171. And I don't really have much content on my YouTube, but I've been working on a bunch of videos because my Twitch, I started that because I'm playing through every single game in this JRPG book. So I'm doing reviews and my thoughts on every single game that I play on my YouTube. So hopefully I should get some stuff up. But that is Bex Gaming Chats. And that should be all of my socials.
Awesome. And listeners, the links to everything are in the podcast description. Becca, Swice Senpai, thanks again for joining me today.
I appreciate it, man. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having us. Yeah, it was so much fun.
Once again, thanks to Becca and Swice Senpai for sharing their JRPG knowledge. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and Twitch. The links are in the podcast description. Let's continue on with some RPG goodness, shall we? A few months ago, I shared my thoughts on Triangle Strategy. I was about a third of the way through the game at the time, and man, I got distracted. It came out right between Elden Ring and Kirby. It was a kind of a good change of pace from the franticness of Elden Ring, but Kirby was also just really chill to play, so I shelved Triangle Strategy for a while. However, a few weeks ago, I started to play it again and managed to clear the game. So I thought now would be a good time to share my final thoughts on this new Square Enix RPG. And let this be a lesson. Just because you don't beat a game in the first month doesn't mean you can't return to it. They're waiting for you. A brief refresher, Triangle Strategy is an HD 2D SRPG developed by Square Enix and Team Asano, the team behind the Bravely series and Octopath Traveler. Asano and his squad of developers have really made a name for themselves on the Switch. Asano worked on Octopath, Bravely Default 2, Triangle Strategy, and Live Alive. That's 4 games in 4 years. All Switch exclusives too, at least at one point. So Switch fans, you gotta show some love, or at least some respect. The last time I talked about Triangle Strategy on the pod, my overall feelings were positive, though I had my criticisms. Now that I've beaten it, I think that summary is still pretty apt, but I will say I probably ended up enjoying the game more as it went along. Looking back on it as a whole makes me appreciate what the game was trying to do and what it accomplished. Plus, after reading a bit about what happens behind the curtain, along with the results of some of your choices, it really made me understand how incredibly ambitious this game actually is. It's not a Final Fantasy Tactics or Fire Emblem clone, despite borrowing heavily from those games. It actually strikes a good balance between tradition and innovation. Perhaps the biggest risk they undertook was minimizing unit customization. Unlike in most SRPGs, the units have a pretty linear path in terms of their upgrades, and not a lot in terms of build variety. In games like Final Fantasy Tactics or Disgaea, you are given a myriad of different classes to pick from, and then you can utilize them in unique ways depending on their equipment they have or what abilities you teach them. Even in Fire Emblem, which has named characters with specific advantages, you still have a bit of flexibility in terms of how you use or grow them. Three Houses was especially liberal in this regard, and at least in unit promotions, you typically have 2 or 3 choices. My Hilda might not be the same as your Hilda. But in Triangle Strategy, my Frederica and your Frederica are very, very similar. There are choices you make in terms of what you upgrade first, and later in the skill tree you can teach them new spells, but each unit has a specific function and you need to figure out how to use them effectively. I can see some people being completely turned off by this, since min-maxing is a big part of what is appealing for SRPGs, but it undoubtedly works in this game. Units are just so different from each other, so much so that I honestly didn't pay attention to the stats at all. In Fire Emblem, I'm thinking, okay, I have 3 cavalry units, which one is benefiting the most from level ups? Okay, I'll pick this guy, as I pore over each and every stat. But the units here have such a specific function that it's less about how much damage they're doing, but instead what role they serve in your greater strategy. You have your typical guys like your DPS swordsmen, your tanks, some mage, of course, but then it gets more open. You can bring in gens, who can just build things to make traversal easier and set traps to block enemies. Or maybe a map has a lot of water, so you bring in someone with an electric attack to take advantage of that. Maybe you start far enough away from the enemy, so you bring in Archibald to snipe them before they can approach. Eventually, you will pick a team of 10 or so that you prefer, but that's mostly because you figure out a strategy that works for you, and not because, well, these are the strongest guys. And so many of the units are just fun to use and have abilities I've never seen in an SRPG. Jens can build ladders to climb up places, or traps to push back enemies, and later in the game, he can even build an auto-turret ballista that just crushes enemies. There's Piccoletta, who can make an AI-controlled clone of herself to distract enemies. And when the clone dies, everyone around her takes AoE damage. Anna is your typical rogue on the surface, but she can literally turn invisible and jump much higher than everyone else. So even characters that fall into archetypes have something interesting about them. Streamlining characters in this way to focus more on their function instead of their build may seem limiting, but I also think that it's very beginner-friendly. If you've never played an SRPG before, this is a good entry point. But that doesn't mean it's easy. I definitely lost my share of battles, but even if you lose or retreat, you still keep the XP gained, so it does give you at least a bit of an edge next time. These type of player-friendly features really help ease people into the genre, and are really nice quality of life additions for hardcores. Triangle Strategy minimizes the menu management and fiddling around you see in most SRPGs, and just RPGs in general. I mean, I can't lie, I do like the menu fiddling. I do like combing over stats and seeing how I can change my characters in interesting ways, but that does make it more impressive that this game completely goes in the opposite direction, but still makes characters and gameplay a lot of fun. In terms of battles, they're pretty much consistently good throughout. They're more compact, but you still need to think carefully about maneuvering around so you don't get baited or overextend. Some have good gimmicks, like being in shallow water, which lets you freeze or electrify it, and the mine map, of course, has minecarts that you can use. You can even run people over. They do reuse maps sometimes, but I didn't feel like the actual battle was that similar. One thing I wish they leaned more into are the chemical element effects. For example, you can melt ice, and then you can use electricity on the water puddle for extra damage. This is a really awesome idea and kind of Breath of the Wild-ish, but they really don't use it all that much. Okay, so the battling part is solid, but what about the story? A major criticism of the game is the lack of balance between the SRPG gameplay and you just sitting through cutscenes after cutscenes. And I think that's a very valid criticism. It's told in a somewhat disjointed way. For example, you'll be brought to the world map and there will be 3 exclamation marks. These are just random cutscenes from different perspectives. Like you choose the one from Heisentine and those guys are talking about whatever. Then you pick the one from Ace Frost and they're talking about their thing. What's annoying is that you select it, then watch the cutscene for maybe a minute, and then you're kicked out to the map again to select a different cutscene. I wish these flowed together more coherently, or honestly, maybe even trimmed down some of the cutscenes. There are definitely scenes that could have easily been chopped out. A lot of suspicious people talking vaguely about secret things. Plus, the cutscenes are presented with in-game graphics. Even something like character portraits would have really spiced things up. The idea that the game is half SRPG, half visual novel is pretty true, to be honest. A lot of this game is reading or watching cutscenes. While it could have been told in a more streamlined fashion, I will say that I definitely enjoyed the story. I love how grounded it is. I won't get into spoilers, but the conflict feels very realistic. Early on in the game, I was wondering if it would keep this more Game of Thrones-style tone, or is the final battle against the God of Dragons or whatever. And it really does keep the consistent tone throughout the game. You don't start fighting aliens. The final boss may seem kind of quaint or low stakes because of this, but at that point you're really emotionally invested in what's happening. At first the world seems incredibly confusing since there are just so many characters, but who is important starts to become more apparent as the game goes on. A lot of the characters are pretty morally gray, but yeah, there's definitely some mustache twirling evil guys in there as well. The motivations of the characters, how they react to events, what decisions they make, it's all logical, albeit still surprising at times. Especially the final decision you have to make. I could not have guessed these would be the paths ahead of me when I started the game. Speaking of the decisions, one of the main gimmicks of the game is the branching paths. Everyone votes on what to do, but you can convince them to join a specific side. Early on you have 2 choices, but then they throw in a curveball and give you 3 choices as the game starts to wind down. These decisions are never easy, and the consequences aren't apparent until you make them. The choices affect the next battle you partake in and can even result in you recruiting different characters. In Chapter 3, you can choose to go to Place A or Place B. Place A gives you one character, Place B gives you another, and you can't recruit the other character at all. So there are some real consequences to your actions. However, no matter what you choose during these big decisions, the story does eventually reach the same point before your next big decision. And the final decision is basically choosing what ending you have, so all your other choices actually don't affect the final outcome of the story. However, there is a golden route, a secret fourth ending that is determined based on your past choices and if you did specific things in battle. It's quite hard to get, and I looked up what happens. Gotta say, the golden ending is clearly the best one. The other three are very bittersweet, sometimes leaning more on the bitter part. I was happy with my ending though, but yeah, I wish I got the golden one. Kind of funny that branching paths and aligning with a certain character has become a notable thing in SRPGs. Fire Emblem is leaning heavily into this now, and Triangle Strategy is too. It's okay to make an SRPG with just one ending. You guys can take a break. I finished the game at about 28-ish hours, which is quicker than most, but I still did all the side battles. It definitely has a lot of replayability if you want to experience the different story battles based on your choice or see all the different endings. For me though, I think I'm good with just one playthrough and then YouTubing the other endings. Overall, I was really satisfied with Triangle Strategy. It's not my favorite SRPG, it doesn't quite reach the heights of Final Fantasy Tactics or Three Houses, but it is a very solid entry in a genre that needs more games. If you like SRPGs, I think you would like this game, and honestly, it's a good entry point into the genre since it really cuts out a lot of the fat surrounding the gameplay. All the fat, however, is in the story, but it's a slow burn, and I bet by the end of the game, you will know and more importantly, care about what's going on. I'm glad I finally finished it so I can check out the, believe it or not, other two SRPGs Square is planning to shove out this year. Or I'll just play Splatoon or something. We'll see. That's it for games. Now let's jump right into our feature. I thought about having some sort of RPG-focused feature to tie in with the games. Maybe I should have saved the Square Enix Cafe for this episode, or just copy and paste that interview into here. But no worries, because this episode's feature is still really cool, albeit light on the HP and MP. This episode's feature is about the Bandai Namco Cross Store, located in Yokohama. So technically not a Tokyo event, but hey, Tokyo and Yokohama are right next to each other. We're cousins, or sister cities, or something. The Bandai Namco Cross Store opened up in Yokohama and Fukuoka on July 7th, so it's a pretty recent addition to the ever-growing number of gaming hotspots in the country. It's not a single store per se, but more of an expansive collection of smaller shops. Think of it like a grouping of several different pop-up shops, but this time they're permanent. Each one is themed around some brand or IP under the Bandai Namco umbrella, though honestly, mostly the Bandai part. Some of these may be changed in the future, and the area is set up in a way to easily swap out or move things around. If one part doesn't do particularly well, it's easy for them to just replace it, or maybe temporarily close one part and rotate a temporary pop-up shop in there. The gimmick of having a lot of mini shops is pretty intriguing and definitely separates itself from the other official game shops in Japan. Nintendo and Pokemon have bigger shops, Capcom has kind of a mini one, Square has stores integrated into the cafes. They all kind of do their own thing in a way, but I think the setup of the Cross Store allows for a lot of flexibility in expanding upon or changing it in the future. Plus, the different shop themes help reach a wider audience. The shop is located on the second floor of the World Porters Department Store in Minato Mirai, Yokohama. Minato Mirai is a massive, expansive recreation area that is filled with huge department stores, tons of restaurants, activities, and attractions. There are mini theme parks, there's a big Ferris wheel, brick buildings turned into fashionable shops, Bayside parks, a giant Gundam that moves. It has everything. Minato Mirai translates to Port of the Future, and it definitely feels like it. Many of the buildings have a sleek, futuristic architectural design, the area is clean and beautiful on a clear day, and is filled with a seemingly endless number of shops. Recently, they even added a ropeway in some parts. So you can travel by bus, car, boat, ropeway. It's really choose your own adventure. Yokohama is a popular day trip for Tokyoites, and you could honestly spend the entire day in the Minato Mirai section alone. Even then, it would probably be impossible to visit every point of interest, so you gotta go back. I've been to Yokohama maybe 3 or 4 times, and there are still so many places I want to check out. But let's focus on the actual shop located on floor 2 of World Porters. World Porters is right next to Cosmo World, a small amusement park most notable for the Cosmo Clock 21, a huge Ferris wheel. It was actually the biggest Ferris wheel in the world when it was built, but it's been topped several times since. A huge digital clock is in the center, and at night there's some projection mapping of different designs. I've seen Pikachu displayed on this thing, so there's a gaming connection. World Porters itself is a multi-story department store, perhaps most notable for the Hawaiian Town on the first floor. It's an area filled with a dozen or so Hawaiian-themed shops, and the food court also has several Hawaiian restaurants. Last time I went, I ate a pineapple burger at Teddy's. I don't know what you think about pineapple on pizza, but pineapple on burgers? Not that bad. Other interesting elements of World Porters are Anitouch, which is a petting zoo. It has your everyday animals like baby chicks and rabbits, but also exotic ones like, get ready, capybaras. You can pet several capybaras here. And take a picture with a toucan. There's also a goofy sci-fi aquarium on another floor. So yeah, this place has quite a lot to do. But I came here for one main reason. The new Bandai Namco Cross store. It doesn't take up the entirety of the second floor, but I would say it takes up most of it. Since it has a very open floor plan, there isn't just one singular entrance, but they do have a kind of a big elaborate gate that is supposed to be the main entrance. However, I didn't even notice it until after I was finished with everything. The first store I popped into was the Bandai Spirits Hobby Shop, which sells plastic figures that you build. There's a fun photo op with a big plastic, I don't know, tray? Sheets? I'm not a builder, so I'm bad with the terminology. One of the main displays was dedicated to Pokemon, so yeah, I'm right at home. Most of the Pokemon ones are pretty cheap, only about 700 yen, and are a pretty decent size. However, they look quite simple to actually put together, so people who are more serious about the hobby might skip over these, but they do look like good ones for beginners. Your typical mons are here like Pikachu, Eevee, Jigglypuff, but they also have some models for legendaries too. This shop also sells buildable figures of Kirby riding the Warp Star, so even if you're not into the models, there's a surprisingly large number of Nintendo items here to peruse. I then jumped over to the Bandai Candy Official Shop. They sell mostly kid-oriented candy, so no gourmet chocolate or anything like that. Japan has a lot of snacks that come with prizes like stickers or small figures. There's a ton of collaborations with anime and games, so these are really popular with kids. Perhaps the most interesting thing here for Nintendo fans are the Pikmin gummies that came out last year. These are gummies that are allegedly the actual size of Pikmin. They look nice and actually taste quite good. These are not rare by any means, but you are unlikely to find them in the convenience store. I've only really seen them at Nintendo Tokyo, so try to grab them any chance you get. Right next to this shop is Bikura Tamago, which is a bath bomb with a toy inside. These bath bomb gag gifts are pretty popular in Japan, and I've seen a few game-related ones. I used a Pac-Man bath bomb, and inside was a small figure of Blinky. I also saw a Tetris one the other day. Near the back of the area is the Gashapon section. Bandai actually owns a trademark for the word Gashapon, but I pretty much just call every gacha machine a Gashapon. I'm not exaggerating when I say there's been a huge boom in Gashapon stores in Tokyo. When I first came to Japan, you really had to search out these mom-and-pop Gashapon shops. But now, Bandai and other companies are making these huge shops filled with hundreds of Gashapon machines. There are so many machines here that it can be overwhelming. There are categories, but these are very vague, like new, or cool, or fancy. Okay, what category does a coin purse shaped like Japanese food fall into? I've bought more than a few Gashapon in my time here in Japan, so I'm always on the lookout for cool ones, especially game-related ones. But nothing caught my eye this time. I have noticed that rings are a really popular item recently, like rings shaped like food, or animals, or just whatever. These seem really impractical to use, though. Next to the Gashapon machines are what I would call the main event for video game fans, the official Pac-Man store, Pac-Man Select. This is pretty much the sole reason why I even came here. And well, it's pretty small with limited merch, but it does have a very nice, sleek design, and there are some fun photo ops. The floor in and around the shop are lined with pack pellets, and there is a somewhat large statue of Pac-Man in the front of the store. The walls are decorated with neon signs of Pac-Man and the Ghost. These seem like they would fit right at home in an arcade. As for the merch, I was kind of hoping it would be some sort of one-stop shop for Pac-Man merch, kind of like a mini Pokemon Center, but for Pac-Man. But it really wasn't. At least for now, most of the merch is based around collaborations with Jack Bunny. What's that? It's a golfware brand. Yes, Pac-Man and golf have combined at last. I guess a Pac pellet is kind of like a golf ball. You can buy Jack Bunny shirts and visors with Pac-Man designs. You can buy driver covers shaped like the ghost. Is this interesting to somebody? I guess people who were into Pac-Man in the 1980s are probably golf playing age now, but it seems like a really weird crossover. And let me tell you, most of the shop is dedicated to these items. Since they are just clothing, the store kind of looks very flat and empty. It's not like the items are popping out of the shelves. They're just kind of folded up and laying there. Another smaller collaboration is with a hat company, CA4LA, where you can buy $80 Pac-Man hats. At least one of the Pac-Man was fuzzy. In the back of the store are Pac-Man-themed Gashapon machines. These were themed around Pac-Man Museum Plus, and the prize are minifigures of the old-school Pac-Man machines. These look kind of cool, but skippable. One of the more surprising items isn't from Japan at all. They had an arcade 1-up version of the original Pac-Man cab there for 93,000 yen. I played some of it and it was neat, but it's kind of weird to see an American import of a Japanese game inside a Japanese store. Also, in the back of the store is thankfully some more appealing merch. They sell Pac-Man themed nanoblocks here, along with some collaboration merch with artist Sebastian Masuda. There are stickers, t-shirts, pin badges, and so on with the sort of graffiti style aesthetic. It actually looks pretty neat. Every time I see a huge sticker, I want to buy one, but I never use them. I keep thinking, should I put it on my laptop? But I never do. Maybe I need to take my laptop somewhere serious, and then it's just covered with like Pac-Man and Kirby stickers. I'll find some solution to my sticker problem one day. A bit unexpected, but I actually didn't buy anything in the Pac-Man store. A lot of it is pricey, which I expected, but so much of it was just themed around specific collaborations of goods a lot of people probably don't need unless you're into golf. I was hoping for some more general Pac-Man merch, like figurines or plushies or, you know, clear files, all that stuff. I think they can't just keep churning out Pac-Man collabs every few months, so hopefully they turn it into more of a general Pac-Man shop in the future. Some other shops, there's a Tamashii Nations, which sells more high-class figures. There's actually a huge Tamashii Nations shop that opened up in Akiba, where the Gundam Cafe used to be, but I haven't checked it out yet. There's also an Ichiban Kuji shop, which is a raffle where you can win random prizes. You can find them in convenience stores in Japan, but the shop has several going on at the same time. There's also Namco-do, which has more idol-focused merchandise. Did you know there are zero Idolmaster games on the Switch? That franchise has completely moved to mobile. Kind of funny since the PSP got an absurd number of Idolmaster games, but hey, things change. I wonder if Bang Dream is more popular. I definitely see more Bang Dream ads at least. A lot of the other shops are very specific, like the Bandai Softy store that sells rubber action figures of Ultraman, or a shop solely dedicated to the One Piece card game, and even clothing and stationery shops. Depending on what type of nerd you are, there's different areas of interest. Some might come here for the plastic figures, some might come for the gashapon, and of course, some may come to pay patronage to the idols. Oh, and there is an arcade, but it's all claw catchers. I think they are missing a major opportunity here by not having a Namco arcade museum or something like that. Put in Pac-Man. Put in Tekken 3. A small little area with six or so retro cabs would be really popular. Though not officially part of the cross store, there are a few other surrounding shops managed by Bamco. There's Shin Japan Heroes Amusement World, a merch shop focusing on Godzilla, Evangelion, Kamen Rider, and Ultraman. It's not just here's Godzilla merch, here's Ultraman merch, but they sell a lot of exclusive theme merch around these four characters as some sort of superhero group. Think of it like the MCU. These are Japan's Avengers. Except they're all from different companies, and Shin Godzilla is certainly not a hero. If you've been paying attention to Japanese pop culture, you may have heard there is a plan for there to be some sort of shared universe like the MCU between Godzilla, Ultraman, and Kamen Rider. Shin Godzilla was a big hit. Shin Ultraman came out this year, and Shin Kamen Rider is next year. I doubt it will be the next big cinematic universe, but if they all cross over, it could be a hit. Also, they sell Ultraman-shaped donuts here and Godzilla hot dogs. Outside the shop is a small VR area where you can play some Godzilla or Ava-themed VR games. If I had one major criticism, it's the register. There are about a dozen or so shops here, so how many registers do you think they have? The answer is one. When you enter, you'll notice a huge line of people cutting through the middle of the area. I was worried they were lining up for the Pac-Man store, but nope, there is just one register you need to line up at, no matter what store you visited. This is pretty absurd for the sheer volume of things they sell, so hopefully they figure something out in the future. So is the Bandai Namco Cross store worth visiting? It's hard to say go from Tokyo to Yokohama just to visit this place, but if you're a fan of any Bandai Namco's toy lines or merch, it should interest you if you're in the area. There's so much to see in Yokohama though, especially if it's your first time, so unless you plan on going to the Ferris wheel or World Porters, I think it's an easy skip until maybe your second or third time in the city. I can see some hardcore Pac-Man fans wanting to check out the official shop, but I recommend you check their site ahead of time to see if they have any merchandise you actually want to buy. The overall gimmick and layout of the place has me hopeful for the future though. They could easily change up the shops to make it seem like a completely new place, and there's the possibility of a lot of fun pop-up shops in the future. I like to see them lean more into the Namco part though. They have a lot of really strong game IPs, so I think just having a single Namco game merch shop is very doable. Pac-Man, Tails, Tekken, Soul Calibur, Dark Souls, you own Dark Souls? If Capcom can have a permanent shop in Shibuya, I think Namco could have a small one in Yokohama. Like I said earlier, there is a cross store in Fukuoka with slightly different shops. Not sure if there will be a Tokyo cross store in the future, but you never know. Oh, and on the way to Yokohama, the train passed by Koei Tecmo's headquarters. Another great thing about Japan, you just suddenly bump into the headquarters of some of the most prominent Japanese developers of all time. That's it for the feature. Now let's look at some news. Okay, news time. Instead of focusing on a lot of smaller stuff, I'm going to talk about only the big items from these past few weeks. Scarlet, Violet, new trailer. We got a Pokemon Presents a few days ago highlighting several Pokemon projects. Honestly, I don't really care about any of the current live service Pokemon titles. They're fine, but I'm not playing any of them. However, I am very excited for Pokemon Scarlet and Violet. We got quite a lot of info in the latest trailer. It was the coming out party for the Paldea region. The name is the same as in Japanese as expected. I think the biggest reveal was the battle gimmick for Gen 9. You can terrestrialize Pokemon. Saying that is going to take a lot of practice. Every Pokemon has a secret third type, a Terra type. When you terrestrialize, your Pokemon switches to that type and moves of the same type are stronger. They also look like crystals with a little decoration above them themed around the Terra type. Okay, gotta get into the weeds about this mechanic. From my understanding and what some leakers have been saying, it works like this. Say you have a Magnemite, who is electric steel, and it has a normal Terra type. When you terrestrialize, it changes to a pure normal type, and its normal moves have the typical 1.5 times stab. Stab is same type attack bonus, which is the buff given to a Pokemon when it uses the same move as its type. However, if the Terra type and original typing are the same, it gets a 2 times stab bonus. So if Magnemite has an electric Terra type, it switches to pure electric and its default electric attacks become twice as strong. So it can serve as a function to completely change your Pokemon type to something else, or to further buff your Pokemon's original typing. I know that sounds confusing, but trust me, it makes perfect sense. I've poked around in competitive communities, and they aren't sure quite what to think. But as someone who isn't super into competitive gameplay, I think it's more of an interesting gimmick than Dynamax, at least. A Pokemon can apparently have any Terra type, so you could have an Electric-type Pikachu, a Water-type Pikachu, a Ground-type Pikachu. Either buffing your current Pokemon, or doing something unorthodox with the on-the-fly type switching, there's a lot of options here that players could utilize in battles. Switching to monotypes for some Pokemon could be a blessing. I love Venusaur, but he gets eaten up by psychic attacks. Switching to pure grass and then using the old Leech Seed plus Sleep plus Giga Drain combo, love it. If it had Thick Fat from Mega Venusaur, I would be in heaven. I think a lot of casual Pokemon fans kind of scoffed at this gimmick, but there's going to be way more options for players now compared to Dynamax. Also, Game Freak is clearly thinking about merch opportunities and selling these crystal form Pokemon, the money is going to roll in. Raids are also returning, and I can't believe it, but they fixed them. At least sort of. You can now attack with your teammates all at the same time. This is easily the biggest thing they could have added to raids. In Sword and Shield, they are very, very slow and have zero strategy. You press A once a minute as you pick the same attack over and over again. At least now it's four times as fast. Raids were so boring, but the rewards were undoubtedly useful, so you kind of had to participate in them. Now they might actually be rewarding and fun. Raids also seem to house rare Terra types for Pokemon, so that would be a major incentive for doing them. The trailer showed off a Water Terra type Gardevoir. Now that I think about it, you could technically have evolutions of every type now, though only technically. I hope raids are easier to get into, though. They also showed off some of the new Pokemon, the poison type Paldean Wooper, Fido, which is a bread dog, and Sedotan, which is an ice whale. So yes, regional versions are back. I love the regional form idea in Sun and Moon because it was based on real biology and reflected the unique ecosystem of the Pacific Islands. But in Sword and Shield, it's like they just had to do it, and the designs and ideas were weaker because of it. Does anyone remember Galarian Mr. Mime or Mr. Rhyme? A lot of the Galarian forms weren't inspired by science, but more by culture. Like you had the Gentleman Weezing and the Viking Meowth evolution. I like the angle that the Pokemon evolved differently due to the natural surroundings more. Paldean Wooper, I mean, he's kind of like a brown Wooper. I'll reserve judgment until I see what else they come up with. Fido was essentially this trailer's LeChonk, the Pokemon with a funny name that everybody loved. It's called Puppy Mochi in Japanese, which combines puppy and mochi. Sedotan looks fine. They are quite reserved about revealing the Pokemon this time around. We've only seen 9, including the starters, and one is a regional form. I'm not sure if you've been following the leaks, but they're out there. I've been reading them all, and there are definitely a lot of very interesting ideas that they have for Pokemon in this game. I won't spoil anything here, but if you don't mind being spoiled, I recommend you search them out. I'm curious when they are going to reveal some of them because they have pretty ambitious ideas and I want to see the reaction to them. More stuff. As expected, the legendaries serve as a transport vehicle. They can turn into a motorcycle or a glider, so basically taking what they had in Arceus, which they took from Breath of the Wild. I think you won't be able to do everything at once, though. The reason why traversal was so good in Breath of the Wild is that it was challenging, and you had to think about how to maneuver, but eventually you could upgrade your stamina and streamline some things. In Arceus, they kind of slowly introduced you to some traversal options. Okay, now you can go fast. Now you can ride on the water. Now you can fly. So I'm hoping that's the same here. They also revealed some new characters, including Penny, who has switch hair. The story seems to have 3 main plots. The only one they revealed was the gym plot, where you conquer 8 gyms. You can do these out of order, but according to the leaks, they don't apparently scale, so it's not like you can do them in any order you like. I'm sure there will be some that are kind of similar levels, so you can choose which one to do, kind of like Sabrina and Koga in the first game. Another story seems to be themed around a treasure hunt. Crystals, treasures, Spain, pirate, it makes sense. The third one? Not sure, but it will probably involve the Bat Team or legendaries in some way. I wonder if these 3 stories will be completely disconnected or will they intersect in some way. In Assassin's Creed Odyssey, you had this sort of multi-threaded plotline. One was about Atlantis and you could complete it well before the main story was over. But it was very weird because there are so many crazy things that happen in that story arc that are never mentioned again. Will Scarlet and Violet have that same sort of disconnect where you will be like, well, I saved the world from the apocalypse, now let's tackle the fourth gym. I'm happy they are being ambitious with the story and open world structure. Everything they've shown off has me more interested in the game. I am a bit worried about the multiplayer. They keep saying that you can explore with friends, but is it only with people on your Switch's friend list? Can you random up? Or can anyone join with a special code? But other than that, it's looking to be a marked improvement on Sword and Shield. Oh, and small bit of other Pokemon news. The 3D display in Shinjuku has a Pokemon Go campaign where the cat Pokemon pop out. I saw it a few days ago and it's really, really cool. Check my Twitter for that video. We also got a Splatoon 3 Direct highlighting new info about that game. This game has had a pretty strange marketing cycle. It was announced in February 2021, and then we just got some random updates about the story mode and Salmon Run. But since it's about a month away from release, we finally got a deep dive on the game. This seems to be a pretty common strategy for Nintendo these past few years. We knew so little about Animal Crossing until the Direct a month before launch, and Xenoblade 3 also had a Direct in late June. So for Nintendo's bigger landmark titles, a Direct 1 month ahead of the release date is fairly predictable. Let's just go through the Direct in order. 2 new techniques have been added, Squid Search, and Squid Roll. Squid Search lets you climb up vertical spaces quicker, and Squid Roll lets you do some invincibility dodge while you're in the ink. Good additions for maneuverability, and the roll gives players more defensive options. There are also 5 new stages and 7 returning ones, so 12 at launch. No kelp dome, though, but I'm hoping it makes it in eventually. A major theme of the Direct is the emphasis on free updates steadily coming to the game, so if there's any specific map or weapon not in the game yet, it'll probably come eventually. And with weapons, we've also got 2 new types, Stringers and Splatanas. Stringers are kind of like a charge bow. It looks like it has 1 main shot and 2 ancillary shots that come out at the same time, so it has a bit of a spread to it. The Splatana is essentially a sword, but it has some ranged attacks. Think of it like the Master Sword Beam. I'm typically more into weapons that can put out a lot of ink over weapons that focus more on KOing players, but I definitely want to fiddle around with the Splatana. I do think it's going to be a super popular weapon, so don't be surprised to see an all-Splatana team if you random up. The Direct showed off some new special attacks, such as the Tacticooler, which gives your team a buff, Wavebreaker, which tags enemies, and Reef Slider, which is kind of like an inflatable shark that explodes after you ride it for a while. Out of these, Reef Slider looks to be the most fun, but Wavebreaker seems incredibly useful, especially at higher levels of play. Knowing where all the enemies are and then taking them out late into the game could really make all the difference. Nintendo also showed off all the shops. Sheldon returns, and in order to buy weapons, you exchange them for Sheldon licenses that you get when you level up. One license is 1 weapon, but you can save up in exchange for a higher level weapon before you reach that level. This is a great way for vets to get the weapon they want quicker. 2 new clothes merchants also appeared, Gnarly Eddie, which is kind of like a Nautilus, and Mr. Coco, a huge lobster or crab or shrimp. He's huge, that's all you need to know. And we finally have loadouts, so we can save our gear setup. This was one of my most wanted additions for the game, so I'm glad they finally added it in. It really helps players experiment more since different weapons are suited for different builds. And once you get dozens of clothing items, it's easy to forget what you own and what buffs it has. We got a lot of other great quality of life changes for the multiplayer. We now enter a practice mode when waiting for a match, and we can also see online friends represented via holograms. You can then talk to them and join their games, or you can tag yourself as someone who is trying to party up. Playing with friends in Splatoon 2 was always cumbersome, so it's great that there is a far more streamlined option now. Splatoon 3 also added lockers to the lobby, where you can customize your own personal locker. You can hang up posters, put in items like skateboards and books, change the color, all that fun stuff. You can buy these items at Hotlantis, and the new merchant is called Harmony. By the way, she's using the Ultra Hand, one of Nintendo's first toys, so that's an awesome callback. Also, seems like you can have Hanafuda card stickers on your locker, so that's an even older reference. This addition is kind of superfluous, but I always feel like I had money burning a hole in my pocket in past Splatoon games, so it's good that there is more to buy. And Splatoon is all about fashion, all about showing off, so it's another thing that you can share with others. Also at Hotlantis, you can buy splash tags, which are just name cards that show up during intros to the battle. I'll say that the background designs for the splash tags look really artistic, so they'll definitely stand out in the introduction. Like the locker, it's just more fun customization stuff to fiddle with in your downtime. Pretty much every shooter and online game uses them, so it was only a matter of time before it appeared in Splatoon 3 as well. And another thing that shows up in a lot of online shooters is also here, a Battle Pass, or catalog as they call it. It looks like a magazine that you can use points from battles to unlock stuff. I mean, okay. It's free and cycles out every 3 months. It seems to be more of a side thing than the main focus on how you unlock items, unlike, say, in Fortnite. They did note that catalogs will switch out every 3 months for 2 years. So, until fall 2024. I wonder if there's something important Nintendo plans to release in 2024. Next up is probably the most surprising addition to Splatoon 3, Table Turf Battle. This is a 1v1 card game. Yes, a card game. You're on a grid with a bunch of squares, and you play cards to change the squares to your color. So it's like a turn-based turf battle, but with cards. This looks absolutely amazing. I promise you now, I will get all the cards. I'll rise the ranks. I'm wondering if they plan on adding more to this as well in the future, or if it's just some sort of weird side thing people play once and then never again. I badly wish there was a physical version though, even as just a collector's item instead of a functional game. I have to think that a physical version will come out eventually though. That's money left on the table if they don't. They also showed off more of Salmon Run. The big new baddie is Kohozune, a Godzilla-like salmon that comes in at the end to ruin your day. There's also Big Run, a seasonal event where the salmon attack Splatsville, it seems. It was a bit vague, but they said that the salmon attacked the home of the Inklings and Octolings, so I assume it's a special Splatsville-themed map. I'm a huge Salmon Run fan, so I'll definitely be pouring some hours into this mode. Along with Salmon Run, we also got a peek at the story mode, but not much. I guess they don't want to ruin anything, but the format seems to be similar to the past few games. There was also a brief mention of Meaty Pay DLC showing Pearl and Marina, so I imagine an Octo-esque DLC is on the way. Then we got some random stuff about making artwork and photo mode, but then we got the main event, the new idols, Deep Cut. We got Shiver, Fry, and Big Man. Their names are Fuuka, Utsuho, and Mantaro in Japanese, with Deep Cut being Surimi Rengo. Fuuka is a type of shark, and Utsubo is a type of eel, so that's where those names come from. Mantaro seems to be a combination of Manta and Taro, which is a typical suffix for Japanese male names. Surimi Rengo is more like Surimi Union, with Surimi being a type of minced fish. So, like with everyone else, a lot of nautical puns. Their group definitely leans more into traditional Japanese performances and dance. The Splatfest they hosted looks very much like an Obon festival, so you've got a bit of Bonodori happening here. Also, their news reports are blatantly inspired by Rakugo, traditional Japanese storytelling. Fry is sitting on a cushion and Shiver has her own kendai, a type of lectern used in Rakugo. Splatoon in general has a ton of references and inspiration from traditional Japanese culture, so it's pretty awesome to see these very old ideas refashioned into modern ways. I mean, millions of kids are going to play a game with a heavy Rakugo influence. That's wild. Gut reaction, I gotta say I prefer Off the Hook to Deep Cut. I do like Deep Cut's dynamic when they talk to each other, and the three-person group is a clever way to mix things up. It's very hard to simply replace Off the Hook, so having at least something a bit different helps a lot. Speaking of the trio, Splatfest will now have three, count them, three options. The first one for the test fire is Rock, Paper, Scissors. This culminates into a strange final battle where there is a tri-color turf war, with the leading team having four players and the other teams having two as you all battle it out at the same time. Hard to say how this works in execution, but it's a new idea for Splatfest and having three options opens up a lot of possibilities. I mean, hello, Pokemon is coming out, so have a Splatfest for each of the starters. If they don't do this, I don't know, Nintendo. I just don't know. I was very positive on everything I saw. I think a lot of people were expecting some huge new addition like a Battle Royale mode or something akin to Salmon Run's addition to Splatoon 2. Instead, we mostly got refinements, quality of life changes, and some additions to existing concepts. But I understand why they don't want to make too many new modes. They are really afraid of splitting the player base. Like if you had a, for example, 50-player Battle Royale mode, well, you've got Salmon Run, you've got Turf Battles, you've got Ranked Mode, and now you've got like a 50-player Battle Royale. Everyone would kind of be everywhere else. So they are really afraid of making people wait too long or splitting the player base. I understand the criticism of it being so long between 2 and 3, and there's not a huge hook, but I'm really excited to get back in Splatoon again with a fresh player base, new maps, and some fun side activities. Last bit of news, Nintendo also released their Q2 financials. Hardware has crossed 111 million and is on pace to top the PS4's overall sales of 117 million by the end of the year. I don't think during the Wii U days many people thought, yeah, the next Nintendo console will decidedly outsell the PS4. They did ship fewer Switch units this quarter compared to the same time last year. 2020 and 2021 were huge for Nintendo due to the pandemic and many other factors. I guess the concern is that are numbers decreasing enough where they can still ride it out until the Switch successor, or do they feel that a Switch Pro boost is necessary? The top 10 Nintendo Switch games didn't change. I was wondering if Arceus would pop in here, but it's still around 13 million while Ring Fit is nearing 15 million. The likes for Arceus have been really undercut by the Gen 9 announcement, but don't skip out on this excellent game. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is at an absurd 46 million units sold. Animal Crossing will probably join the 40 million club soon as it's at 39.3 million. The new titles for the quarter include Nintendo Switch Sports, which sold 4.84 million in about 2 months, an excellent start to this franchise revival. It's not a game that is going to sell big out of the gate and then drop off. Updates are coming, and since it's a cheaper casual game, it should sell steadily through the Switch's lifespan, like Super Mario Party and Clubhouse Games. Don't be surprised if next year it crosses 10 million. Mario Strikers Battle League sold 1.9 million in just a few weeks, outselling the previous entries in the franchise. it will probably soon outpace golf and maybe even tennis. Kirby is at 4.53 million units, which makes it the fastest-selling Kirby game and will likely become the best-selling one. The numbers for Dreamland are 5.1 million, but the early sales figures for a lot of NES and Game Boy titles are really spotty and probably inflated. I think Kirby could eventually cross 10 million. It's selling steady, it's a good casual title for young gamers, and a lot of people who aren't Kirby fans jumped in with this game and had a good time. During the next financial report, we'll be looking at numbers for Xenoblade 3 and Splatoon 3, and see if Splatoon 3 helped push some new hardware. I think Splatoon 3 has a good chance of cracking the top 10 sooner than later. Ring Fit has been holding on to that last spot for dear life, though. Now for the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This week's phrase is Daipon. Daipon. It means to slap the arcade unit out of frustration. Dai can be used for many things like platform or podium. It's referring to the button area here. Like when you get creamed by some SNK final boss and then need to let out some frustration on some innocent hardware, that's Daipon. Don't hit arcade machines, though. They are a precious resource and we don't have many of them left. There has to be a very limited number of Budokai 1 cabs out there. Once more, Daipon. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. I picked one from Kazumasa Yasukuni. It's some awesome fan art of Samus in the gravity suit. Strong shadows, striking colors, and this beautiful purple. I always thought that it was weird that Samus' ultimate suit was, you know, purple. I guess it kind of predicted the GameCube and GBA era. And as always, the tweet is in the podcast description. That's all this time. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on Sunday, August 28th. See you next time. Matane!